If we hold certain values to be true, if we have certain beliefs in how we do business and certain behaviors that come from those beliefs, how can we make the artificial intelligence reflect those values? I would guess that at the moment it's being treated as an IT thing and managed by an IT team under an IT director, and that may be separate from the people director who's responsible for culture or the brand director who's responsible for brand strategy. So especially in larger businesses, they tend to be managed rather in isolation. And what I'm always trying to do is connect those teams up so that we get a more consistent experience.
Welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast, hosted by Andy LaPata, the show where Andy and his guests explore the many ways in which relationships impact business decisions, make leaders' jobs easier, and help you to progress your career.
Hello and welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast. I'm Andy LaPata. Thank you very much for joining me. As it's Easter, we are doing our normal thing and dipping back into the archives with Connected Leadership Gold for just a couple of weeks. And to kick us off this week, we're going back about a year to April 2023, when I was joined by Ben Afia, who specialises in making businesses feel and seem more human. And we had a discussion about whether AI could replace humans. So thank you very much for joining me, Ben Afia.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me, Andy. I'm going to be as humanly possible.
Well, that would be a great start when we're talking about making organizations human. It's good. We haven't quite got to the point where I've got an AI bot as a guest on the podcast yet. Not quite sure I'm going to let that through my filters for some time to come.
I think you should try it.
So I don't want our conversation to be all about AI, but obviously with everything that I've referred to that's happened in really recent months, the conversation has only been front and center for a matter of weeks. So I think that this is, as I said in the introduction, a broader topic, but let's start with AI. How do you see bots like ChatGPT and Google's Bard impacting the way brands communicate? Are you seeing anything happening in these very early stages, or is it something that you're really looking down the line?
I think it's early days, but clearly at the moment, at the time we're recording, there's a lot of fuss about it. So ChatGPT-3 came out in November, I think. They got the number of subscribers in within 2 days that Facebook got within 2 years, something like that. I mean, absolutely enormous growth. So it's quite remarkable. But I have been looking at artificial intelligence for a long time because as somebody involved in branding, in language in particular, and writing and how we communicate, I've been worried about how soon AI is going to take my job. So I've been keeping my eye on the market. I spoke at a conference for a company called Acrolinks about 4 years ago in Sweden. I was keen to sort of get to know them and understand how they're applying artificial intelligence to content. And they in particular do huge quantities of kind of translations. So for example, for companies like Volvo, who have to translate car manuals or digger manuals and documentation into every language in the world, they do that kind of volume of work. But what I learned at the time, and it'll be interesting to see how that's changed now, was it didn't really feel like that language was particularly human. So the intelligence was capable. It was doing an effective job. It was relieving pressure on humans. It was an adjunct to humans doing their jobs. But it's only really now that we're starting to see it come through in a way that I think is more human. So I've been playing with ChatGPT, as many have, the last couple of months. And I'm thinking, okay, what can I use it for in my business? How can it help my clients? One thing that's been interesting is how it can summarize meeting notes. And in my work, I do a lot of interviewing, partly taking briefs from clients, but also interviewing people, executive teams, and people throughout organizations. So can ChatGPT, can artificial intelligence help me to summarize and bring the data together from those interviews? And I think that's quite an exciting space. But the other that is a more direct application, there's maybe a surprise for some, is to marketing. Now, I think we thought that artificial intelligence would be coming for the kind of the lower level jobs initially, and that the creative jobs might be longer protected. And actually, it seems like it's going to be the opposite. It's coming for our creativity. So how are people using it now? They're using ChatGPT as prompts to generate ideas for headlines, for writing the first draft of a landing page, of sales copy, of email copy, newsletters, that kind of thing. I would say it's quite cliched. So the writing that I've managed to get out of it is fairly standard stuff. And I guess that's probably because it's looking to a database currently that was fed into the system in September 2021. So it's not current data. It's a little bit out of date, but it is still quite extraordinary what it can do. And a colleague actually put my website through ChatGPT and asked it to write an article about it. And it was spookily accurate. I mean, it was really quite astonishing what it managed to do. So it's very exciting, but it is still early days. It's not writing I would send to a client or want be confident putting on my website. And I certainly wouldn't use it for, you know, writing strategy for my clients, but I think it's an assistant.
There's a lot to unpack there. And obviously there is the whole conversation about who AI is going to impact and how it's going to impact different roles. For the purposes of this conversation, I want to pick up on something you said, because you said you've been looking at these various sites in terms of how they can help your clients. Now, our conversation today is about whether AI and just generally, you know, how we make our organizations human and whether there is a threat to that human connection. When organizations are looking at using sites like ChatGPT, do you think that they're one of the challenges is they might not be coming from the same perspective as you, that they may be thinking about how is this going to make our lives more easier rather than how is it going to make our clients' lives easier or serve our clients better?
Yeah, I do think there's a risk there. So I've been scanning Twitter and seeing lots of sort of marketing speakers, consultants getting very excited about what ChatGPT can do for you. But as I sort of said briefly, I don't think it sounds very human yet. So there's something about a generic experience that we get from a company that makes us feel pretty fed up. What do I mean by that? I think it's when we don't feel like we're being treated by a human, like a human being, as an individual, we can sense it. And that tends to happen with businesses that are quite hidebound with systems and processes. So larger businesses, larger, older corporates who have very defined processes, often the handoffs between teams can be quite abstracted and we feel like we're being passed from pillar to post. And that is quite an inhuman experience when actually what we really want is for one person to take ownership and solve our problem. So the risk with artificial intelligence and the generic nature of the output so far is that I think it risks us feeling disenfranchised, disconnected, and not connected as humans. And so I don't think it's fit for human consumption just yet. But we are where we are now. What we know about it is that artificial intelligence learns incredibly quickly. I heard a story about when artificial intelligence beat Garry Kasparov, the chess master. I think that they had fed in the rules of the game, then the artificial intelligence played itself for about 4 hours and was then able to beat the world's leading chess master. So it's something that learns incredibly quickly. And that's the thing that's quite extraordinary. So I think that more human output is likely to come fairly quickly. Now, one thing that makes us human is empathy. And so the question for me is, can artificial intelligence actually have empathy for human emotions? And if we think about us Brits, for example, who might complain in a very passive way, we could say, well, that's a bit disappointing, when actually we mean that we're really bloody fed up. So I was working with Vodafone, actually, in their Indian contact centers who support British customers. One of the cultural problems that they had was understanding when we're making a complaint and misinterpreting our gentleness and lack of directness sometimes. So it'll be very interesting. If we now think about this talk of AI being able to diagnose illness better than surgeons, better than consultants, and that's extraordinary. And I guess that's about pattern matching. There is a risk of bias. There was an article I read this weekend about using artificial intelligence to detect crime or possible crime that has been tried in states in the US, and there's a risk of then targeting particular minority groups because of the data that's fed into the system. So it's quite a complex picture, but there's a lot to play for, and I think it's quite exciting.
So going back to this point about you're looking at how using artificial intelligence can serve your clients, and my suggestion is that if companies are coming from the other way around, how can we use it to serve ourselves? It's actually the data input that causes the lack of humanity in interaction. So you use the example of companies that are very process driven, tend to leave a much less human or positive environment or experience for the user. So, my suggestion here is it's not all about AI. That when we're looking at creating a human connection, maybe forget about AI. We have to look at how we create our systems and processes and how they're experienced by the user. Are too many companies coming from what makes life easier for themselves rather than what's going to enhance the client experience?
I think that's the risk. I mean, a lot's going to depend on the data that's fed in and how you manage it, how you train your AI. So it depends on the question, the data that you put in and the questions that you pose and the way that you frame those questions. And that's going to be individual for individual companies. So from my perspective, what I'm thinking about in terms of culture and branding within an organization, I'm thinking about values and behaviors. So if we hold certain values to be true, if we have certain beliefs in how we do business and certain behaviors that come from those beliefs, how can we make the artificial intelligence reflect those values? I would guess that at the moment it's being treated as an IT thing and managed by an IT team under an IT director. And that may be separate from the people director who's responsible for culture or the brand director who's responsible for brand strategy. These tend, especially in larger businesses, these tend to be managed rather in isolation. And what I'm always trying to do is connect those teams up so that we get a more consistent experience. So it's about the training. But it's also, I think, about the questions that we ask and what we're trying to get it to do for us. So if I think of an example, as I mentioned at the start, I do a lot of interviewing and I have a lot of meetings. And one of the things that I've always struggled with in my career is writing up meeting notes, which is always a good discipline to kind of repeat back what you've heard from a meeting. And that helps you, the person that you've spoken to, feel that you've heard them. It's a good discipline, but when you're busy, it's quite hard to do. Well, so I tried that with some notes from a client meeting just recently. And it turned the notes into a good summary and then into an email. And I phrased the question three times. And on the third attempt, the email was pretty good. So something that would have taken me an hour to think through and write it, craft an email to a client with the purpose of making a human connection and making them feel heard, actually I condensed down to about 10 minutes. So as an adjunct to a human person, to a person doing a job, I think that's probably the scope initially. That's certainly the sense I'm getting from the people who are talking about AI. And that's how I'll be encouraging my clients. Quite whether it's ready for prime time in terms of customer service, probably not yet. We've all had experience of chatbots that just completely misunderstand what we're trying to get to. And we really just want to talk to a human. But that's probably the next step.
Okay. So I think it's a really interesting example and you can see how that will work. I'm going to try and rephrase my question because I don't think I got it across well enough. Mm. I want to broaden this beyond just AI now. So not talking about AI, but using that as the, what you've said as the example. So you talked about organizations that had a lot of systemization, a lot of processes, and that was impacting the user experience. So my question is, with or without AI, do we have a problem with organizations appearing and feeling human in their connection to their customers?
Yeah, we do. And I think the source of the problem is that the sort of senior people in the business have generally a very clear idea of what they're trying to do and the kind of experience they want to give to their customers. The problems in businesses that are anything from, micro business, from scale ups and upward, into corporates, once you get sort of through 100 to 150 people, you start to get a level of bureaucracy and politics and silo formation that tends to get in the way of effective connection. And what I tend to find is that businesses are quite inwardly focused. So the marketing team, their job is to gather information about customers and make the connection with customers. And customer service team are the people responsible for actually having those conversations. But they're not necessarily always joined up. So I think it's a problem that comes with size, that comes with scale, and it becomes very difficult to manage. So you have teams working in silos, not necessarily, and quite often on separate systems. So the customer service team may have one database and the marketing team are working off another database, and the two aren't talking to each other. And that's really common, because making those connections, you know, it arises for historical reasons, but making those connections is very expensive and time consuming and difficult, and it often doesn't work. Our big IT projects often fail. So there are institutional problems, I suppose you could call them, within organizations. And then the other part of that is that the people responsible for talking to customers day in, day out, because you need a lot of them, they don't tend to be your most highly paid and highly trained roles. So in customer service, that certainly in this country, I don't know if it's the same in the US or other countries, but certainly in this country, they're not the best paid or best trained employees. And I'm not sure I really understand why that is the case. Customer service tends to be targeted on the number of calls that you get through, and then a customer service satisfaction rating like Net Promoter Score, NPS. It's very commonly used. So because you can measure thousands of people dealing with thousands or hundreds of thousands of customers, people do measure. And so I think the wrong things get measured. My feeling is that companies need to be measuring the quality of the relationship that somebody forms. And if you empower and equip and train somebody in customer service to solve a problem for a customer first time, they are so much more likely to not need to ring up again, which costs you time and money. They're much more likely to go and recommend you to your friends, to their friends. They're more likely to buy from you again. So you get loyalty, you get retention, you get referral in the jargon, and a more profitable business as a result. So there are organizational challenges that get in the way of people being more human. And quite often, you know, I've worked with customer service teams for probably the last 25 years. And by and large, they're people who really want to do a good job. But quite often they're thwarted by the processes that supply, you know, give them the information, or where they've got to hand information onto, or who's the next person in the chain.
Enhance your mentoring skills with the Financial Times Guide to Mentoring by Andy Lapata and Dr. Ruth Gotian. Secure your copy early by pre-ordering today on Amazon or your preferred bookseller.
It's really interesting you say about the wrong things being measured and the importance of building deeper relationships, because as someone who teaches referrals, I've long been frustrated by Net Promoter Score because it seems to be used as an end in itself and not a means to an end. The amount of times I've been asked if I would be happy to refer an organization, but then not been asked for a referral, just baffles me as someone who teaches that topic. But all they want is to be able to turn around and say, look, 9 out of 10 of our customers would refer us, but they never bother to actually ask them, which to me just seems absolutely ludicrous. The other example for me would be the amount of times that I'm asked at the end of a transaction or a conversation, and you know, any type of interaction these days, which is another bugbear I know for a lot of people, you know, can you score us for how happy you are with this interaction? You know, you can walk into a shop and ask for directions and you'll get an email the next day saying, you know, were you happy with the interaction? But if you score it low, you don't get a follow-up. People aren't following up and saying, well, what was wrong? They just are taking the scores on. So what's happened there? How have we gone from 0 to 100 on the data we collect, but we're still stuck on 0 with what we do with that data?
Yeah. It's really interesting what's happened. And I think there's something of the law of unintended consequences there. So Fred Reichheld, who wrote The Ultimate Question, which was the book that detailed the NPS approach, Net Promoter Score approach, he's recently come out with a new book to try and correct the problem. So I was working with E.ON about 15 years ago when they were rebranding from PowerGen, when the German E.ON bought the UK business. And I did work with them for about 8 years. We were looking at the brand story, the brand strategy, the tone of voice, training people throughout the business. And Net Promoter Score was at the time very hot at E.ON, and in many, as it is in many businesses. So it got incredibly popular. And that was the time that I read The Ultimate Question. Fast forward a few years, and Fred has recently come out with a new book trying to expand on the idea, because he feels that his original idea has been misused and it's led people down a path. Now, I haven't read the new book yet, but before the end of the podcast, I will find the name for you, because it is very much about being more human in business. He's absolutely talking about humanity in business. And this is, I suppose, one of the problems, that businesses tend to be run by people who have quite a logical bent. So often chief execs come from finance, so they'll be a CFO before they're CEO, or they come from operations, COO before CEO. It's not that usual for them to come from marketing or another discipline that's more kind of human-centered. And because of the needs of shareholders and investors, businesses tend to be quite numbers-driven. And so the challenge then is at senior team, exec teams, the focus is very much about numbers. And I find the focus on numbers can be in conflict with the focus on human beings. So you can see how, the NPS score, scoring out of 10, is as a shorthand for whether you're making customers happy, is great for numbers-focused people. But it leads to the wrong conclusion sometimes. And that's what trying to fix, actually. How do we help people to recognize within businesses how their customers feel so that they can make them feel better? How do we tune into the emotion when we're being driven by numbers? And the same goes within the organization. So if we're driven by numbers and targets internally, how does that affect the nature of the relationships that we build? Are we focusing on how our colleagues feel, or are we focusing on the output that they deliver? So I think it does lead to alienation and less humanization. Yeah.
I'm glad we're on the same page there. Let's take it back a step, because in your previous answer, you talked about businesses with over 150 employees. And that's where a lot of the processes and so forth that we were talking about seem to kick in. How important do you think the size of the business is in terms of their ability to connect in a human way with their customers, or any external or internal, as you say, stakeholders, communicate with humanity to whomever it might be? How important is the size of business? So a smaller business is more human. Is there a stage at which, after a certain amount of growth, a company becomes more human again? Is there a bitter spot as opposed to a sweet spot where companies lose it entirely? How does that play out?
Yeah, really interesting question. So believe it or not, before going into business, I studied archaeology. This was in the early 90s. And an Oxford professor of anthropology, Robin Dunbar, published some research in 1992 defining what became known as Dunbar's number, and the number is 150. And Dunbar started by studying evidence of Neolithic, so Stone Age societies, or late Stone Age societies. And he noticed something interesting, that when a village seemed to get to a certain size, a group would split away and form and start a new village. So you can imagine kind of the youngsters, probably the older teenagers and 20s, going, we've had enough of these old duffers, we're going to start our own thing. Of course, that's happened for time immemorial. But so this number of around 150 seemed to be critical for him. So he delved into, what is it about this group size? And the way he defines it is, it's the number of loose relationships where we know who everybody is and we know how everybody else relates to each other in the group. Beyond that number, the idea is that it then becomes harder to hold that in our heads. And so we become alienated from those people. He's then taken this number and looked at organizations, and he steps forward into, say, the Roman army, which had a repetition of, which had maybe a unit of 8 or 10 people, a platoon of 30, and a company of 120 to 150. And other armies followed the same structure, including the British Army today. And so what's interesting about this group size is he then starts thinking about how this might apply to other organizations. Robin Dunbar, a new book coming out actually that talks about this in some detail. It's coming in the next few months. And so what does this mean for organizations? Everybody who started a business or is leading a business will recognize a time at which a size of community at which they no longer knew everybody by their first name. And that's how the director of the chief exec of a pet insurance company that I've been working with for a few years typified it. He said it was that point where he no longer knew everybody by first name. Things started to get a bit weird. And I do think there is a change that goes on in organizations when they go from, say, 100 to 150 and through that size. It's not a strict number. It's not like, you know, once you're over 150, everything's different. But it's the size at which things become a bit more political. You need more bureaucracy. You need processes in order for teams to work effectively together. And because of that bureaucracy, it means that there are systems in place of people and conversations. But also you find that because people don't know each other quite so well, they tend to hold on to information. So that's where silos start to form. So I mentioned earlier on about how your marketing brand team may not be on the same page as your people team, as your customer service team. And that's the point at which this starts to happen, where the communication starts to break down. So I'm really interested in what do we do about that? And I think it takes a slightly different style of leadership. You need to be much clearer about where you're heading. You need to be really crystal clear about your strategy, your vision, your purpose, your values. As a chief exec, that's your prime role, I think. And then you need to be very consistent in the way that you communicate that. And you need to communicate the same story day in, day out. Because when people hear slightly different stories, that's when people start to get confused about where they're heading. And if there's any confusion there, you're not making the best use of their discretionary effort. People do want to work, and generally, I find, want to do a good job. But if they're confused about direction, it's hard for them to do that.
Talking about the discretionary effort makes me think about something like the McDonald's, the Ray Kroc franchise model. Now, having run a franchise myself, I always say that where we didn't get it right was we were too loose in how we controlled the franchise. And if you look at Ray Kroc's model for McDonald's, every McDonald's is exactly the same experience. Wherever you go in the world, you know exactly what you're going to expect because everything is laid down step by step. It's processes on steroids. Hmm. How do you get that balance right, where you have the right layers of control as an organization grows, so that you can maintain a brand, you can maintain a culture, you can maintain an experience that is consistent wherever anyone interacts with that organization, but at the same time, you encourage people to use that discretion, because surely you have to encourage your employees to be human if people's experience of them is of humanity.
Yeah, really good question. Because there's this tension, isn't there? It's between having control and not having control, and empowering and disempowering people. So I guess what I'm saying is, how do you have enough control without disempowering people, without taking people's ability to choose? Because people don't give of their best if they don't have some ability to bring their own skills and personality to bear. So, yeah, really good question. There was another author who tried to solve this, Michael Gerber, in The E-Myth Revisited, which was one of the earlier business books that I read.
Yeah.
And he explains it quite well, but he missed, I think, something that I tend to focus on now. But what he really got right was, I think, to develop systems and processes. And so he starts from being a very small business and how you get larger. And I can remember him talking about how, you know, as a founder, once you've nailed your bookkeeping system, for example, the task is to document it, to write the process. And then when you are able to afford it, you can recruit somebody into that role and you've documented the process. So then the next step is to train that person to deliver that process. And then hopefully you are automating something, you know, you're delegating effectively and giving that role to somebody else. So each element of the business, every process in the business, you can document and train people to adopt so that you free your time up as a founder. And I think whenever you're establishing a new team or establishing a business, you're trying to do that. You're trying, you know, in order to scale. So how do you do that with leaving people some freedom? And I think that comes from having clear purpose. I don't remember whether Michael Gerber talks about this, but my focus is very much on the strategy. So how do you articulate the direction that you're heading in? So what is your purpose in the world? What's your mission? What are you setting out to do? What do you believe in? What are your values? What are your behaviors? And all of those things can feel like you're trying to construct some kind of cult, but I don't find that's the case. Invariably, when I go into a business where there isn't that direction, when I talk to teams, they feel a little bit rudderless. They don't know what is expected of them. It's not been spelled. So because it's not been written down and spelled out, they're actually not quite clear on what's the right behavior and what's not. So I think guidelines actually are extremely useful. And if we think about language in particular, which is something that I've specialized in over the last 20 years, you know, when I first got into language, I did worry, and I did my first tone of voice project at Boots, and I worried that people would feel it was too prescriptive and telling them how to write. And the challenge with the way that we use language is it's part of our professional persona. It's like putting a suit on to go to work or a t-shirt, whatever. So we use language in a way to convey our professional persona, part of our personality. So it's a very difficult thing to change. And so I worry that people wouldn't change and wouldn't want to adopt a tone of voice that you're trying to encourage. But actually, I found the opposite. I found that if you give just enough guidance, but not too much, so a small number of techniques that give you direction. So for example, if you are, let's say we're in financial services tends to have the technical culture underlying financial services is the kind of culture of the actuary, you know, the statistician. And so the language of the actuary tends to come through, and that can have a sort of a formality to it. There's also quite a lot of compliance and legal language that comes through. So in order to speak to customers, consumers, we probably want a bit more warmth, because that actuarial or legalistic language can be quite offensive actually at times. So how do we show the customers that we're on their side? We might want to be warmer, and then we can find ways in language to be warmer. Well, if I was trained as an actuary, or if I've worked in financial services all of my life, I might not know how to do that. But if you can tell me, use shorter sentences and use contractions like I'll and we'll and you'll, that will give you touches of warmth. I now know, if I can use those things, and I actually feel empowered. So as long as your direction gives just enough to give people the clues, but doesn't tell them how to do it all the time, I find that people are excited about it rather than crushed by it.
Yeah, I like that, because you made me think about when I used to work in direct sales, cold calling, and you'd be given a script. Just before we got on this call, I had a phone call. And, as soon as someone says, hello, am I speaking to Andy Lopata? How are you today? I put the phone down because I know it's a script. And, you know, we used to have these scripts that would be several paragraphs long before you'd let the other person speak. I couldn't use them. And we were told you have to use a script. I never did, because it didn't allow me to have that human connection of hearing the other person's voice, of having a conversation. So that show them how to, but don't tell them what to, I think is a really important differentiation there.
I bet you're a better salesman as a result.
Yeah, I was still rubbish, but I was a lot better than I was before.
Probably a similar experience to me in my early career as well.
Yeah. I had my moments, let's put it put it that way. Yeah. When you prescribe to the degree that my old sales organizations did, and some companies that are really heavy on process do, you know, go back to the McDonald's example, how are you today was a brilliant innovation when it was introduced, but then it became a running joke, you know, and you knew that no one meant it. So when you get that balance right, and instead of prescribing, you're showing, does that create more of an emotional connection? And is that what's lacking when we lose the humanity in the way that we connect with our customers? And as I say, again, not just customers, but stakeholders internally and externally.
It is, absolutely. And it's a tricky balance to get right, but there is an approach that I find, strangely, a lot of people haven't heard about, but can help. And it's called appreciative inquiry. And it's an approach to change that starts by looking at what's already working. And I find it's fantastically powerful in organizations. So if we take our specific example, let's say we want to give guidelines for how we want people to sound on the phone, for example, what language that they use, what's the phraseology, what kind of words. One way we can use this appreciative inquiry is to explore times that the organization is at its best, the people in the organization, what they're like at their very best. So in order to define that language, that tone of voice in the first place, if we start from hearing stories about times that they're at their best, we hear genuinely the behavior that they're using day to day. What that enables us to do is to focus on the behavior that we want to see and that is already there. So it's actually relatively easy to adopt because it already exists. You're not telling people to do things terribly differently. That gives people a much more confident place to start from. And then when we've defined, so we can use this to define the strategy, but then we can invite people to use the same process, this appreciative process of interviewing each other and telling stories of times that they've been at their best, to think about as a team how they can adopt new behaviors. So if we want to see more consistent behaviors over multiple countries, you know, if you've got thousands of people over the world, it can be quite hard to control. So we have to give some freedom. But if we start from what's already working and get people telling stories of times they've been at their best, I find that that's incredibly empowering and it encourages people to adopt the right skills. And quite often you don't even need to tell them what to do. I had a project a few years ago. I was working for Severn Trent Water, one of the water authorities, the privatized water businesses in the UK. And the problem that they came to me with was that they were getting too many complaints that were being escalated up to chief exec. So there was something going wrong in the complaints process and they wanted to solve this. They had 60 people in the senior, in the sort of the chief exec complaints team, in the senior customer service team. So very deeply experienced team, and they knew how to do the job right. But again, a very large organization where the systems and processes can get in the way of being yourself and doing the right thing. So I ran a couple of appreciative inquiry workshops with this team. The output that they wanted actually was some guidance on working on the phone and working in writing so that they would show a human connection and therefore reduce the likelihood of complaints, make customers feel more comfortable, make them feel looked after. And I think they imagined that we would come out with some tone of voice guidance. And the amazing thing was that we didn't need it in the end. So we had 60 people workshopping, exploring stories of times they've been at their best, looking at the common themes that come out of those things, the thing that they valued from those experiences. And we discovered that all of those best past experiences were times of a personal connection, times of good communication, where they'd worked effectively as a team, where they felt that their colleagues had had their back. These stories that people tell are almost never times when they did things completely on their own. They are team, mutual, collegiate experiences. And so when we recognize these experiences, people go, we know how to do this. We've already got it. We just need to focus on it and do more of it. So that's the way I help to get through, you know, from strategy through to implementation through an organization.
That outcome that you've just illustrated there is exactly, you know, I think what comes through on so many of these conversations that we have on the Connected Leadership podcast, so much of the work that I do, it's things that people do know and they have within themselves or within a team. And it's sometimes or often a lack of focus and clarity rather than an inability or lack of skill set. And that goes back to too much focus on the numbers, too much focus on the processes. And I am a believer in processes, but too much focus on them without understanding what we're trying to achieve will hold us back. And maybe it will be the same whether it's delivered by humans or delivered by bots. It's really understanding what your objectives are that drives your communication.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And interestingly, I don't know if there's something about the algorithm at the moment. I'm getting articles about consultants, management consultants, and the downsides of government being overrun by consultants. The idea that you can parachute in very bright, highly educated people who don't necessarily have the specific expertise, but can help transform and bring management thinking into organizations. I have a completely different approach. My thinking is that the answer is always within the organization. It's almost always within the people. That doesn't mean sometimes that we do need to bring innovation in, but actually quite often I think we just need to unlock innovation from within. It's already there. Your people have the knowledge. Your people on the ground know what needs to be done. They're talking to customers. They're talking to clients. They know what needs to be done and they just need to be unleashed. So I do think the answers tend to be internal. We tend to look externally for answers. And I'm an absolute sucker for that. I'm I have a thirst for learning and reading and absorbing new stuff. But interestingly, as I passed 50 last year, I'm starting to realize I'm reading the same thing time and again. And I'm starting to wonder whether I've read quite a lot of it already, and it's harder to pick out the genuinely new thinking. I think the answer is within us, within our organizations, and within our people.
Yeah, recently or on an ongoing basis, I'm involved at the moment with writing my next book, which is the Financial Times Guide to Mentoring. And the reason I say recently is actually in the last few days as we record this, but not in the last few days as it comes out, we've been working on the chapter of the difference between mentoring and coaching. And I had a conversation with the chairman of the Association of Business Mentors, where he threw consultancy into the mix and made the point that consultancy is the pure telling, whereas coaching is the pure questioning and helping people find the answers within themselves. And mentoring hovers somewhere in between. And I think that what you've just said reflects that conversation as well.
Well, 7 or 8 years ago, I trained as a coach. And I've always taken a coaching style approach. And I suppose we should define what we're talking about, shouldn't we? I mean, the way I think about pure coaching is asking questions that help somebody come to a conclusion for themselves.
Yes.
And the idea behind that is that if we come up with answers for ourselves, we're much more likely to take action on what we've found. When somebody tells us what we should do, we tend to resist it. Think about kids.
and just to add to that, Simon Fordham from ABM, his inverse of that is consultancy is telling them.
Yeah. So my style of consultancy is actually much more of a coaching approach. And when I trained as a coach, that's interestingly, I feel like I became a much more effective consultant. So it's not like the Big Four style of consultancy going in and assuming a level of knowledge and expertise. I actually go in knowing nothing about somebody's business and knowing that I will never know as much about their business as they do. And I can't possibly. So how can I possibly just hand them an answer? I think effective consultancy that makes change, effective change, and is and therefore value for money and achieves an outcome starts from building on the resources that already exist within an organization and adding to them and helping them to transform rather than parachuting in something completely different. So I think I find a coaching approach much more powerful. If I can help my clients think, I've often thought this, I remember as far back as 15, 16 years ago working with Eon, that we're so busy in businesses, we don't have time to think often. And I think that's how consultants and agencies are often, you know, leaned on as people who are there, who can take the space and time to think through a problem properly and develop an approach, develop strategy, because we're just so busy. So yeah, but a coaching approach helps that, you know, whatever we come up with to be accepted.
And tying that back into the theme of the conversation, if organizations, if leaders who have brought consultants in have more of a conversation with them rather than just being told what to do, that's a more human experience, isn't it? It's a more connected experience. And surely one of the biggest frustrations for people who don't feel like the organizations they're dealing with are dealing with them in that connected, humane way is because they're being told what to think and what to do and not being asked.
And I think this is a fundamental problem in leadership, actually. So I think it's human nature. We want to be heard. We have a need to be heard. We need to feel heard and appreciated by the people around us. And I know that command and control leadership is on the wane. It's not disappeared completely, but it's softened. But I think we're a long way from true coaching cultures. And I have a vision for all business actually being led through coaching. I had a conversation recently with one of the large global corporate travel booking companies, BCD Travel. One of their senior vice presidents, who was one of my clients a few years ago, I interviewed him for my forthcoming book. And he told me one of the problems that he's got at the moment is as a Gen Xer, so he is approaching middle 50s, he's recruiting younger millennials and Gen Yers. And he's finding that their needs are quite different from when you and I entered the job market. and they can be quite demanding sometimes. They join the company and they're sort of expecting a development plan immediately, and they're expecting a promotion and a pay rise after 6 months. When you and I enter the job market, we expected to have to work for that, and we might get rewarded if we got things right. But my advice to this old client was that if he adopted a coaching approach, could he pass the question back to his employees and say, okay, so how would you like to develop? Where do you see your career? You know, I can give guidance and I can give suggestions, but it's up to you where you want your career to go. I'm just here to support you. So a coaching approach to that question would be to not take on the responsibility of the development plan, but saying, you come up with a development plan. We can talk about it. I'll coach you through it. I can show you, you know, open your eyes to opportunities, and I can support you to develop that. And we can talk about coaching and training that can help you get there. But as an individual, as an employee, it's your responsibility to take that on and to develop it. And that's more of a coaching approach, helping them to come up with the answer for themselves, because then they're going to own the answer. They're going to own the plan, and they're going to feel ownership of the results that will lead to the promotion and the pay rise. So I would like to see more of a coaching style culture in all organizations. And it almost becomes a bottom up where, you know, the pyramid is flipped upside down, where the leadership's job is actually to coach their people. And the more effectively they coach the people, the better, you know, the better the people are at delivering the work and looking after customers.
And that's a nice point to close on. It reminds me of a conversation last year. I can't remember exactly. I think it was one of our podcasts, but which one has gone out of my mind for the moment. But it was basically on the, you know, the premise was, if you treat people right within the organization, they then treat people the right way who are outside the organization and across.
It's very hard to show empathy for customers when your leaders are not giving you empathy. You need to feel safe. You need to feel looked after. You need to feel supported in order to give your best to customers, because customer service is emotionally draining. It's a tough job. So you need to look after those people so they look after your customers. Absolutely.
Great stuff. Ben, thank you so much for joining me on the Connected Leadership Podcast.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Andy.
Thank you for joining us for this dip into the archives. I hope you found that interesting. Next week, we will be looking at navigating the dangers of burnout at work. While you are recuperating and recovering over the Easter break, we just thought we'd remind you of a few things to bear in mind when you go back into the workplace. So join us again next week for another episode of the Connected Leadership Podcast Gold.
Thank you for listening to the Connected Leadership Podcast. If you found this valuable, please subscribe, tell your colleagues and friends, share on social media, and post a review on the podcast channel you use to listen to it. And of course, join us again soon for another interesting interview and great connected leadership tips.